All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a really tight show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Lauren Markham, author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. And this has been called An Urgent Chronicle of Contemporary Immigration. You don't want to miss this. This is going to be a very, very interesting conversation.
And opening the show up, we're going to hear an interview I did recently with Palestinian author and professor Sari Makdisi. So here it is.
I'm very pleased to welcome to the show my guest. His name is Sari Makdisi, and we've spoken many times in the past. Sari is a professor of English and Comparative Literature at UCLA. He is also the author of a very good book, Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. Sari, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. We recently spoke to Richard Falk about the situation with Palestine and what's been happening there, but it was more approached from an overall situation of the world and what's going on. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you is because in addition to that, you also have a very deep understanding of the particulars of what's happening in Palestine, in that part of the world, and to the Palestinian people. You've described the announcement by the head Nazi in charge, Trump, that the U.S. will now recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel as a death blow to the often talked about idea of establishing a two-state solution where both the Palestinians and the Zionist settlers will each have a state. Why?
First of all, because Jerusalem is the key, has always been the key to actually any kind of settlement, but particularly to the two-state solution that has long been talked about, in fact, for too long been talked about. So the idea of a two-state solution is premised on the separation of Jerusalem into east and west. West, the west part of Jerusalem would go to the Israeli state, and the east part of Jerusalem would be the capital of the Palestinian state. And what Trump has done, the first thing is that he's given his support to the idea of one Jerusalem that's obviously going to be under Israeli control from his point of view. But the second thing is that when pressed as to where is this Jerusalem, what are its spatial limits, what are its boundaries, you know, where is it geographically, where does it exist geographically, I'm sure he couldn't even find out on the map. But anyway, the White House has been very elusive about what Jerusalem actually means. The reason why it's the death knell for the Palestinian state and hence for the idea of a two-state solution is that Jerusalem, as it's presently configured, is a kind of strange geographical creature. So basically, the Israelis captured East Jerusalem in 1967. They'd captured West Jerusalem in 1948. But when they captured East Jerusalem after 1967, they expanded the municipal borders of Jerusalem. So they pushed deep into the West Bank, what had been the West Bank until the Israelis captured it in 1967. And they added all this land from villages outside of Jerusalem to the east of Jerusalem to the municipal borders of Jerusalem. Then they annexed the whole thing, and they said this is all the capital of Israel. Of course, this is all totally in violation of international law, in violation of the Geneva Convention, and so on and so forth. The point is that when Trump says we recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, he is presumably, in some way or other, including recognition of that land grab and the illegal annexation of all this land from the West Bank, as well as, of course, the capture of East Jerusalem. Now, a couple of more legal things that we could talk about, the political dimension here. One of the other really important legal things is that the U.S. and the United Nations and international law has been very consistent until Trump's announcement. It's been very consistent that occupied territory is not subject to annexation, because to say that you can just grab somebody's territory and then illegally annex it to your own territory means that basically it sanctions the conquest of territory and, you know, the acquisition of territory by force and so forth, which is a violation of international law. So Trump is also giving his blessing to the acquisition of territory by force, another violation of international law. Now, the political repercussions of all this basically is that since the Israelis have expanded the municipal borders of Jerusalem deep into the West Bank after 1967, what that means is that recognizing all that is Israel essentially all but cuts the West Bank in half, north and south. And there are more settlements that they're building that are east of what's already pretty far east in the West Bank that would really separate the West Bank into north and south. And then within each of these two parts, north and south, there are further subdivisions because of the Jewish colonization of territory within the West Bank. To wrap it all up, what it means fundamentally is that there's no territory left for an independent Palestinian state. And with the loss of Jerusalem, there's no capital for this state. In other words, there will not be a two-state solution. That's where we are right now. This is not necessarily all bad news, because a lot of Palestinians, including myself, but many, many others as well, have long abandoned the idea of a two-state solution in any case. Because, first of all, there's long been not enough territory for a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza because of the pace of Jewish settlement and colonization in the occupied territories. And more importantly, the two-state solution never did anything for the rights of the 1.5 million Palestinians who live inside pre-1967 Israel. And it certainly did nothing for the rights of Palestinians living in exile, the refugees, and basically the single biggest block of the Palestinian people who live in exile. So the two-state solution excluded all those people and had no way to answer all those questions. And in any case, it's been sort of a dead duck for a long time, but Trump's declaration really puts an end to it.
Shortly before this latest development, Netanyahu, the Zionist premier, argued and gave a speech and talked to people about the fact that he says he is, in fact, in favor of establishing a Palestinian state separate from Israel. So really, what's all the big to-do about this? How would you speak to that?
Well, I mean, the Israelis have often talked about some kind of Palestinian state. The thing is, it comes down to what your definition of the state is. So my definition of the state, and I think most people's definition of the state, involves contiguous territory, contiguous borders, involves control over its own airspace and water and natural resources, and entry and exit and this kind of thing. The Israelis think of a Palestinian state as this kind of amalgamation of bits and pieces of land disconnected from each other except through Israeli control, with no control over its airspace or borders, with no control over its natural resources. In other words, it would be like an archipelago of little islands disconnected from each other except via Israeli control. Now, the Israelis, of course, say if Palestinians want to call that a state, they can. Palestinians have so far, you know, refused to do that. But, you know, there are certain Palestinian so-called leaders who would be willing to sign on to such a thing. But fortunately, they're still kind of in abeyance at this point. But yeah, it wouldn't be a state. It just comes down to what the definition of a state is. The idea that there can be a territorially contiguous, independent Palestinian state at this point in the West Bank is basically impossible. There is no more territory for that state because of the pace of Israeli colonization in the West Bank. There's no longer a block of contiguous, continuous space in which to create a state and in which to have borders that say this is where the state begins and ends. It can't be done anymore. And so that's why there won't be a Palestinian state. And then, of course, well, the question is, well, what's the alternative to an independent Palestinian state? And more Palestinians are now demanding the creation of a single state in what is today Israel and the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem, that would be a state in which Palestinians and Israelis would live as equals, as fellow citizens in a single state. Some Israelis accept that, most Israelis reject it. But, you know, as I've often said, the Israelis who reject the idea of equality and democracy are kind of like the French aristocracy who rejected democracy in the 18th century, or the British aristocracy who didn't want to give the swinish multitude the right to vote in the 19th century, and so forth. So they may not want it, but that doesn't mean that that's how history is necessarily going to unfold.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sari Makdisi. Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA, and he's also the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're talking about the current situation in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, and what's going on with the declaration by Trump that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Now, Sari, there's this whole situation where concretely what this move by Trump and the U.S. imperialists means for the Palestinian people, it's horrifying. There is a reality to ethnic cleansing. Even the fact that there is an Israel is based on the understanding by a lot of the major Zionists that there is going to be ethnic cleansing, that you can't have Israel with the Palestinians still in the picture in any real way. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that the foundation of the State of Israel necessitated ethnic cleansing, and that's not just my claim. That's the claim of, obviously, many Palestinians and even many mainstream Israeli historians as well, including Zionist historians, for that matter, such as Benny Morris. More to the point, when we talk about what Trump just did as a kind of negative in terms of the Palestinian experience of the Palestinian people, I mean, of course it is, but it's not as though they were living in good conditions before Trump came along and made his declaration. So all of the previous U.S. presidents, Obama, Clinton, going back, you know, Bush, et cetera, all the past several, going back to Bill Clinton, at least, if not before, they've all overseen this, what's called the peace process, the net result of which has been, first of all, accelerating Jewish colonization of the occupied territories, so the building of more and more and more settlements outside of the State of Israel, inside Palestinian territory in the West Bank. Secondly, it's involved on a micro scale, dispossession, expulsion, removal of population, in other words, ethnic cleansing, even though it's on a small scale. But on the large, like in 1948, hundreds of thousands of people were expelled from their homes by Zionist militias. So that's large-scale ethnic cleansing. The ethnic cleansing that goes on now is more like this family here, this village there, this person here, this person there. It's like in drips and drops, not large-scale. But when you add up all the drips and drops, it adds up to a lot. So, for example, the Israelis are very, very persistent in trying to strip Palestinians who are from Jerusalem of their right to live in Jerusalem. In other words, Palestinians who live in the city, who have Jerusalem residency papers and so forth. The Israeli state is keen to strip them of their residence and hence to remove them from the city, because a Palestinian without residence papers can't enter Jerusalem, basically. And so in the past several years, the Israelis have stripped literally thousands and thousands. I think the last number I checked was something like 14,000 Palestinians who are from Jerusalem. They can't enter Jerusalem anymore, the city in which they were born, where their lives are, where they have family and work and so on and so forth. And that's ethnic cleansing, of course. It's not ethnic cleansing like you don't bring trucks and put thousands of people on them and, you know, drop them across the border, which is what happened in 1948. It's, as I said, small scale. It's a family here, a couple there, a child here, a parent there. It's bit by bit. But again, over time, the bits and pieces add up. That's all been kind of the background music to the so-called peace process. So the peace process, its main accomplishment has been the further erosion of Palestinian territorial contiguity, the further settlement of Palestinian territory by Jewish settlers from Israel, and actually from outside Israel for that matter as well, and the slow, bit-by-bit dispossession of Palestinians literally from their own homes, their own houses. House demolition in East Jerusalem, house demolition in the West Bank, and by the way, house demolition for Palestinian communities inside the State of Israel. In fact, the most intensive site of home demolition these days in the past few years hasn't even been the West Bank. It's been Palestinian communities inside the State of Israel, in particular in the south, in the Nakhab, or what they call the Negev Desert, where Palestinian villages are being destroyed, in some cases repeatedly, in order to make room for forests or parks or new Jewish settlements, again, within the borders of the state.
One time, actually, when I interviewed you when your book first came out, and you were talking about some of the stuff in Gaza, for instance, and you made a point that's always stuck with me. Basically, Gaza has become sort of an open-air prison camp for Palestinian people there. It's when you look at the way that the Israelis, the Zionists, actually came in and the devastation they caused, the horrifying things that were brought down on the Palestinian people, it really does amount to a genocidal assault and turning it into, as you said, an open-air prison camp. Let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, I mean, Gaza certainly is. It's a holding pen for 1.5 million people who aren't allowed to go back to their homes. Most of the people who live in Gaza are refugees. They're not from Gaza. They don't want to necessarily be in Gaza. They come from towns and villages and cities, mostly in southwestern Palestine. So they want to be able to go back to their towns, to their villages, which in many cases are walking distance from the Gaza Strip. In other words, if you were to open the gates of Gaza and say, you can go home now, most of the people in Gaza could literally walk back to where their villages are or were. And, of course, those villages were destroyed after the 1948 war. But in most cases, in fact, it's one of the strange things about Israeli geography, Palestinian geography, is that where the villages used to be, for the most part, even though they were demolished or bulldozed or removed one way or another, the sites are still there. They weren't necessarily resettled by a new Jewish population in the rural areas. So the strange thing is, literally, if you were to open the gates of Gaza and say everybody can go home, these people would literally walk back to where they came from. And from my point of view, that's, of course, a way to settle the whole conflict. The conflict is not about existential threats. It's about who has the right to live where. And the Israeli claim is that you have to belong to a certain ethnic background in order to live in a territory of the state with full rights and full freedom. And, of course, the Palestinian narrative is we want to be able to live where we come from, where our people come from, where our families come from, where we literally own land, we have real estate, we have keys, we have houses, we have either collective or individual or family property, and so forth. It comes down to that. It's not a very complicated conflict when you think of it in those particular terms, but that is what the conflict is fundamentally about. So it's about if you want to have a state in a land that has always historically involved different kinds of populations, it's always through history been a heterogeneous multicultural space and territory with lots of different people, cultures, languages, religions, and so forth. If you want to take this space and make it into a state that only has one ethnic identity and one religious identity, it's going to involve violence. It has to involve violence. That's what the undertaking is, to make the multicultural into the monocultural. It's a violent project by definition. And certainly as long as people are saying, no, we're not going to go along with this plan. If you want to end it, you have to embrace multiplicity and multicultural difference and the different kinds of people living in equality. The Israeli state adamantly refuses to embrace equality. It adamantly refuses the idea of having a state that treats all citizens equally. And by the way, just parenthetically, the Israelis and the supporters of Israel in this country go on and on and on about how Israel treats all of its citizens equally. That is simply not true. There is no law in Israel that guarantees equality to all citizens. There is no such law. It just doesn't exist. There is nothing in the legal system of the Israeli state that guarantees equality before the law. The law explicitly discriminates between Jewish and non-Jewish people. That's what it comes down to fundamentally. So the Palestinian claim at this point is, with the idea of an independent Palestinian state in the background at this point, the Palestinian claim is, let's all live as equal citizens, and the Israelis categorically refuse the idea of equality. That's what the struggle is fundamentally over. One side is demanding equality and justice, and the other side, clinging to this insane project of trying to create a monocultural state in a multicultural land, says we refuse equality. That's what this is all about fundamentally.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sari Makdisi. Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA, and he's also the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And we're talking about the current situation in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, and what's going on with the declaration by Trump that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Well, let's get a little bit more into this. When you look at this, there is no place safe for the Palestinian people in the territory that's supposed to be Palestine. I look at Palestine as Palestine is Palestine the way it existed prior to 1948. You don't just come in and erase an entire country and an entire culture. And I kept thinking about this. All of the sort of the political and the cultural things that are being mushed together and pursued by the Zionists, actually what it comes down to is when you watch the land and the homes of the Palestinian people in the West Bank, even there, the people who have been able to settle in the West Bank, their homes and their land are actually, they're very temporary things. If some people come in from Israel and they say, we want these places, suddenly there's all kinds of ways found to get rid of the Palestinian people living there, and these places become the homes and property of the Zionists.
Yeah, that happens not just in the West Bank. That happens all the time in East Jerusalem. It happens in the south of the country. It happens in the Galilee. It happens all over the place. But to speak to the first point you made, Michael, the first point is, there is no safe space in which to be a Palestinian. So Palestinians in Palestine, whether they're the nominal second-class citizens of the state of Israel or those living under occupation in the West Bank, or East Jerusalem, or Gaza, and, of course, Palestinians in refugee camps in Lebanon or Syria or Jordan, none of them have any kind of stability or security. There's nothing that stops, in some way or other, a Zionist force from taking their home and expelling them, whether it's the state itself or agents of the state or settlers acting under state protection or settlers acting while the state looks the other way. In one way or another, there's extreme 24/7 vulnerability on the part of an entire people, an entire population, millions of people. And yes, that is the reality. That has been the reality for over 60 years at this point. That's where we are now. And so again, the Palestinian demand is for one of the right just to be normal, just to live a normal life without living in dread and fear and terror of home demolition or losing your house, or a bunch of fanatics claiming to be in personal touch with God, saying that this land is theirs or this house is theirs or this neighborhood is theirs and not yours, and so on and so forth. So let's concretize this, because this can go into abstractions too easily. I'll give you a quick example. There's a village in the south of what I call Palestine, what they call Israel. It's a village called Araqib. It's in the Nakab or Negev desert, where it's a village that in 2010, the Israeli state said, this village is illegal, so we're going to demolish it, and we're going to plant a forest on top of where the village used to be. And so the Israeli state came, and they sent border police and bulldozers and whatnot, and they demolished the village. This is in July 2010. And then the unusual thing about this village is that the people who lived in the village stayed, and they rebuilt it. And then the Israelis came back, and they redemolished it, and the people rebuilt it, and the state redemolished it, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Until the last time I checked, which is a couple of weeks ago, that same village had been demolished 120 times. So we're talking about a village of, I think it's 1,000 people, who are citizens of the state of Israel, at least on paper, although the state obviously doesn't treat them as equal citizens. And their homes are literally 120 times have been demolished and, you know, put back together and demolished again by this state in order to build a forest, to plant a forest, that will be for the pleasure of the Jewish residents of the south of the country. That's what this is about. So imagine living in a state that could just take your land and expel you and demolish your house and say, we want to put a forest here. Even though that has been your land, that is your land ancestrally, going back countless generations into the mists of time, you have no, as far as the state is concerned, you have no claim. The state considers you, in fact, in the case of these Bedouin Palestinians, the state literally, legally considers you to be an intruder on its space, even though that is where you're from, that's where you've been from ancestrally going back countless generations. But that, again, when you think about the village of Arafib, that is a case of ethnic cleansing on a very, very small scale, like 1,000 people. It's not like 100,000 or 700 or 800,000 people. It's micrological almost, but take that and multiply it by all the experiences of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem who had their houses broken into by fanatical Jewish settlers who then take over the house or the apartment or the flat or whatever it is, and they dispossess the Palestinian inhabitants of the place with the blessing of the state or while the state looks the other way and hems and haws and so forth. But that is the reality on the ground continuously.
Now, one more question along those lines, which is the growth of the Zionist colonizers. This is not something that's sort of just like a few goons here and there or a few people to come over and they're just like out and they decide that they want to do this. But there actually seems to be a very well orchestrated growth and pushing out by these Zionist colonizers, and it's constantly increasing. And meanwhile, what's focused on and put out to the people of the world is that the Palestinian people are asking for too much. They're pushing for too much. They're jeopardizing the well-being of the Zionists, when actually the Zionist colonizers are constantly increasing with their assaults and attacks on the Palestinian people. And what even the Zionist regime claims to uphold is like the right to the Palestinian people to this section of the area. But actually the reality is they don't want the Palestinians at all.
Yeah, they never wanted the Palestinians. And it's not, the thing is, I mean, of course, you could talk about it in terms of, you know, gangs of colonizers, but as you say, it's a state. This is a nuclear armed state with a massive, you know, army and air force and so on and so forth up against an unarmed, largely unarmed, certainly largely defenseless population. And it's a totally lopsided conflict into which Mr. Trump has now sailed and declared the U.S. to be firmly on one side as opposed to the other. And that's it. But you know, what I want to reiterate is, on the ground, what's been going on for literally the past 20-plus years of the so-called peace process is nothing. It's the same thing. It's not like anything has changed on the ground. It's been this long, continuous process of dispossession, expulsion, home demolition, and colonization. That's been the continuous process all through the background talk of peace and settlement and two-state solution and whatever. Right, so, I mean, Trump has sailed into this, and Trump being Trump, you know, he's like a bull in a china shop. He has no idea of the history. He doesn't know where anything is. Jared Kushner and whatnot, that people are telling him to do this and do this, and he's trying to feed his base back in the U.S. domestically for political purposes. So his move was malicious, and it was nasty, and it was unpleasant in all kinds of ways. But materially on the ground, it's not like it's bringing some new material reality into being. The reality will go on being what it's being, which is dispossession and on the one hand, and on the other hand, resistance. And that's a very important point to emphasize. Palestinians don't just, you know, take this lying down. They resist every single day. And people often talk about armed resistance, but in fact, by far the most important form of Palestinian resistance to Israeli encroachment is simply continuing to exist. So the most important way Palestinians defy and resist Israeli rule is by raising their children, by going to school, by teaching, by farming their land, by taking care of their shops. That is, all those things are acts of resistance on a day-to-day level. They are just this continued existence, a continued resilience in the face of all of these forms of aggression is the most powerful form of resistance that Palestinians have offered the Israeli state. And, of course, it's the one that the Israeli state has the hardest time dealing with, because when Palestinian factions fire rockets at Israel, it's very easy for the Israelis to say, oh, look, we're under attack and this kind of thing and the violence, etc. But when Palestinians are being steadfast in their own homes, and the images you get, as we've been seeing the past few days of protests, I'm sure you've seen them too, images of burly Israeli soldiers ganging up on Palestinian children, beating them up with rifle butts, that just doesn't look good, you know? And when Palestinians are demanding equality and justice, and the only answer the Israelis have is inequality and injustice, that doesn't look very good. So, again, Palestinians are realizing this, which is why the entire struggle is shifting from one of armed struggles, sort of classic 1950s, 1960s variety, and national liberation and this kind of thing to a project of unarmed resistance, disobedience, boycotts, sanctions, divestments, protests, mocking, you know, demonstrations, and so forth. It's a, in the name of equality and justice, that's a much, much, much more powerful struggle. And it's one that the Israelis have no means to deal with. They don't. It throws them into a total panic. If you charge the Israelis with apartheid, which is what we're talking about legally, not just as a slogan, but just, you know, in terms of international law, they don't have a defense. I mean, they don't know what to say. You know, give them rockets. They're very happy to deal with rockets because it's easy for them. In any way, they have the upper hand militarily. Give them a call for equality and justice, they go into an absolute panic. That, for them, is the real threat. And I think that's, of course, where the Palestinians are increasingly focusing their attention collectively as a people, as the two-state solution fades into the background.
All right, Sari, and you're ending up on a very, very complicated question, and it's one I think that we really need to give more consideration to in the future, because it's a very serious question for people in Palestine and people all over the world, and that is, what is it actually going to take to really liberate Palestine and the Palestinian people? And I look forward to exploring that further with you in the future. All right, Sari Makdisi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, take care, man. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sari Makdisi. Sari is a professor of English and comparative literature at UCLA, and he's also the author of Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. And he writes frequently on what's happening to the Palestinian people in the occupied territories of the Middle East. Now, I also want to do something that we haven't done for, I don't think we've ever done this, but it's something that my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, actually made a comment about. It would be good to talk, just to put out to people an idea that sometimes, you know, look, a lot of people, a lot of you are out there, have a lot of ideas about what could be covered or what you want to see covered. And while we have a certain, you know, sort of idea of what the show needs to be in terms of what we need to bring to people, that also includes hearing from you the subjects that you might think are really important for people to hear. So now, as we go into the New Year's, you know, we've covered a lot of politics, science, and the arts in 2017, and we'll continue to do that in 2018. But I want to also have you guys to actually write to me and tell me some subjects that you might want to hear us do a show on, all right? So you can contact me on my email at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Write to me. Let me know what you want to hear on The Michael Slate Show, all right? Now, we're going to listen to a song that I think is very fitting. It's Outer National, called Across the Borderline, so check that out.
There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold. Just across the borderline, and when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand, and you'll know it's too late to change your mind. You paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the borderline.
Up and down. Fine.
Every dream slips through your hand, and you know it's too late to change your mind. 'Cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you still just across the borderline.
All right, welcome back. And once again, that was Outer National, and it was featuring vocals, a guest vocal appearance by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. A beautiful song, just a really great rendition of it, and I thought it was really appropriate for what we're talking about today. Now, just a little while ago, a couple weeks ago, a friend called me and said, I have a book that you have got to read. I just read it. It's sad. It's just, it'll knock you out. It's just a very powerful book, and I've spoken with the author of the book, and I want to hook you guys up. And so you need to play, you need to do a segment on this. And I got the book, read it, and immediately I had to actually get the author of this book on my show. And her name is Lauren Markham. She's the author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. It's the story of twin brothers growing up in El Salvador in the wake of the Civil War, being forced to flee as unaccompanied minors and struggling to find a new life in the great American unknown. Yeah, great American unknown. And it's unfortunate when so many people come here putting everything on the line that they do, it becomes the great American known. And we need more people to know what it's all about. Anyway, I was really moved by this book, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show now Lauren Markham, who is the author of the book. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, as soon as I heard that recommendation and I started reading the book, I just couldn't stop. And it's really...
That means a lot.
Yeah, well, it's something that really needs to be spoken to today, and especially in this climate that we're looking at, where you're going from everything from the dreamers to, you know, everything else that's happening, and you're looking at what's happening to people and the need for people to both understand it, but understand also when you understand something or when you recognize something, there's a compulsion that you're faced with, too, about doing something about it. So I wanted you to start off giving people an idea of... Well, give them a synopsis of the book, but also what its origins were.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book, many of us might remember the immigration crisis of the summer of 2014, the unaccompanied minor crisis. In the summer of 2014, the population of unaccompanied minors, and these are young people who've crossed into the United States without papers or parents, they're generally apprehended. The vast majority are generally apprehended very close to the border. And in 2014, that number skyrocketed. It had actually been almost doubling for several years. But in 2014, the government's sort of ability to house and feed and clothe and just kind of give very basic services to these young people was just overwhelmed. They should have known that the numbers would keep rising because they had been, but they didn't. They didn't prepare. So many of us might remember the kind of media blitz of that summer. And I had been writing about unaccompanied minors for a couple of years, kind of with this question of what happened, who are these young people? Why are they leaving? You know, anytime all of a sudden one particular demographic or a few, you know, in this case, young people from Central America start moving, like we have to ask why. Why are these people moving? What are they leaving? Why are they coming to the U.S.? Why so many of them? I had these questions and they felt very urgent to me, and nothing I read sort of satisfied the answers I was looking for. And so I began interviewing young people and began writing about them for about this population and this changing dynamic for a couple of magazines. And then I decided that I was sort of never satisfied again. I kept wanting to write more and learn more. And so I decided to write a book. And so the book actually follows the story of two particular unaccompanied minors. The book is called The Faraway Brothers because in El Salvador, the euphemism for someone who's migrated away is hermano lejano or a faraway brother. So the particular faraway brothers I write about are Ernesto and Raul Flores. They come from a rural town in El Salvador, and they, like many unaccompanied minors, sort of end up on the wrong side of the gangs that have been rising in control and in brutality in the post-Civil War years in El Salvador, and they've gotten particularly bad. And the rise in gang violence tracks pretty much exactly with the rise in young people fleeing the country.
Now, tell me this, because one of the things when you talk about this, this is a big shift. I mean, the migration from the South, it's been going on for a long time. But early on in your book, you do point to exactly what you're saying. There's been a significant change in the character of this. Now, what's happening with the older skilled people? What's leading to that change? What actually led to that change where you have the older skilled people who are either just desperately trying to eke out a continued existence there, or for a lot of them, just going home and not going back?
Yeah, well, so it used to be that the most common profile of migration of people coming into the United States from Central America and from Mexico, letting aside sort of in the post-war, after the 80s, in the 80s, hundreds of thousands of people were coming here because there was a war going on, and a war that, by the way, in El Salvador, the United States was funding and supporting the government forces against the leftist guerrillas and government forces that perpetrated mass atrocities. So it used to be that the people who migrated for sort of economic reasons were economic migrants. They were coming to the United States. It was generally the father or the mother who was coming of a family, younger adults, but adults generally who had kids, who would come to the United States, get jobs, and send money home. In 2008 and around 2008 and after, with the economic crash in the United States, the number of adults crossing unauthorized into the United States began dropping, and significantly so. And around 2011, the number of young people started growing. So there was a historical average of around 7,000 unaccompanied minors who were apprehended each year before 2011. This past year, there were 40,000 at the height, which was a couple of years ago. There were about 60,000 who crossed. So the profile really is changing. People aren't coming here for financial reasons anymore as much, although, of course, people still come to the United States for financial reasons. The main driver of the Central American exodus right now is violence. And young people are the ones who are recruited into the gangs. The vast majority of deaths and murders in the Central America's Northern Triangle, which is a region that includes Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, the vast majority of murders are young people. So young people are really at the front lines of this very strange and unconventional war, which is kind of a war between gangs and between gangs and the government.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more, because this is something I was really intrigued by. And I mean, it's horrifying what's happening. And when you look at this thing of actually the gangs that form up in the, you know, gangs were not always the sort of the dominant force in these various countries, in whether it's, you know, whether it's in El Salvador or anywhere else, they weren't always the dominant force in terms of determining what's happening inside the society and what's going to happen in relation to, you know, people leaving or staying. What you're talking about is a very significant change that these gangs have come into it. And in some ways, I mean, even when I was reading your book, I kept thinking, okay, what's the relationship between the gangs and the army and what's going on here? And, you know, and you're actually looking at a whole new, where at one point in El Salvador, you were looking at this vicious regime, and then you're looking at the army coming in. And now, you know, from what you're saying, it's a lot like a lot of this is being taken up by these youth who were recruited as gang members and then actually became, this is how they make their living, and this is how they support their families. And this is sort of the way you do things now.
Yeah, or it is an increasing force. And these gangs have grown in the wake of a brutal civil war. So you have generations of people who are deeply traumatized. It should be noted, and this is an oft-repeated fact, but at the same time, as much as I see it talked about, as much as I talk about it, it's always surprising to me how few people know this. But MS-13, this gang that is one of the main gangs in El Salvador, it's a gang that Trump and Sessions used to like to talk a lot about to sort of instrumentalize kind of hate and fear against immigrants. And there's sort of these accusations that these young people are bringing MS-13 into the United States, which is the vast majority of young people are fleeing these very same gangs. So in any case, MS-13 was born in Los Angeles during the Civil War among young Salvadorans who had, either without papers or some availing themselves of papers, come into the United States and were living in sort of poor urban neighborhoods and modeled their gangs after pre-existing gangs in the United States. And once those people were jailed and then sent back to El Salvador, they brought MS-13 with them. So the gang violence is actually an import of the United States. You know, that was like in the 90s when these gang members started being deported back, kind of post-war El Salvador. But they're really rising and growing in power in the context of a post-war society that has very limited economic opportunities. They're currently in a country of 6 million. There are 300,000 young people who are not in school and out of work. The vast majority of young people don't go past the sixth grade. There aren't a lot of job opportunities for young people. And so there's this sort of repeated cycle of violence and of trauma, coupled with the fact that the government is not providing the basic needs and services, right, that people want and need, like education and healthcare and jobs. So this is the sort of shadow economy that has become one of the dominant drivers in Salvadoran kind of politics and in the economy. And I should say that a lot of people do join gangs in order to, like you said, a lot of young people do join for economic reasons and to be able to support their families, to support themselves. They also join out of, like, sometimes by force. They're told that if they don't join, they'll be killed or their mother will be raped. And sometimes they join for a sense of belonging. They might not have a family. But it's not like sometimes we have the idea of these gangsters being these sort of like flashy high rollers. And the reality is most gangsters, even the high level ones in El Salvador, are not living the high life. The living that they're eking out is still just scraping by. We're talking like a couple dollars a day.
Now, tell me this. Well, actually, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lauren Markham. And Lauren is the author of The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life. It's a really powerful book, folks. You want to get this book. It's not one to be missed, all right? It's really going to open your eyes up, and it's going to have you sitting up. I'll tell you what, Lauren. I sat up all night with your book, okay?
That's very nice of you.
Well, yeah, it is, but it was also really troubling. Because you know, it's exactly, I mean, you know, what you talk about in there is so vital for people to understand on a lot of different levels. There's the question of the oppression of these various countries, and there's a question of the youth and how do you look at this and what happens to people who are coming up here. Like you say, people actually, one of the things that comes across very hard in your book is that people actually come, a lot of these youth come looking for some way, like urged to go by their family. They go to save the lives of their family, to make some money, to try and make some money to do this, to, you know, to get away from all this. And they bust in there and they find themselves once again, sort of like what happens when you get to the States. It's not a very good picture if you actually even manage to get there, because the scenes that you paint along the way of the how hard it is for these youth to actually get to where, you know, whatever city they're going to try and get to once they just right. even cross the border. It's phenomenal. And it's mind blowing what they have to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. The journey itself is horrifying. And that's why, you know, it's important to remember how horrifying the journey is, because this is not a decision that's taken lightly, right? Like you were very, very, very like, let's not mince words here. You are risking your life to make this journey to try to get to the United States. And Raul and Ernesto, who I write about, both kind of experience horrific things along the way. And I should say that they're, and this is true of their story in general, it's like by far by a long shot, the sort of worst or most horrifying story I've heard. In a way, theirs is more tame than many others that I've heard. So the journey is really horrifying. And yeah, you know, there's the American dream looms large around the world, this idea of what's possible when you get here. And then, you sort of encounter the reality, which is that, yeah, sure, if you live in Oakland, you can make 12 bucks an hour, which sounds like a fortune in El Salvador, but your rent's $500 a month and your bus fare, and it ends up being a lot more difficult to just scrape by living as a poor person in the United States, as many of us who already live here know, right? Mm-hmm. So that's facing the reality of what it is to be poor in America is a really hard sort of second journey for the migrants. And I think for migrant youth too, who haven't necessarily ever been in charge of money or had to sort of take care of themselves in the way that adults might have.
Yeah. You know, there's something else as I keep thinking as you're talking, I keep thinking about the bike story in your book. And it really was so beautifully written. And so it was so powerful because, you know, you remember when you were a kid and the importance of a bike and the freedom that represented and the way that you could just like, and the way they had these three kids piled on a bike and soaring through their town or wherever they were. And then at the same time, coming up flat, right up against reality in the form of their father. And it really kind of captured a contradiction. I thought this, here you have this like this exuberance of youth alive in the world and then the realities of what is happening all around them. And the realities that force even their father to become pretty much a hard-nosed jerk a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so glad that scene stuck out to you, because that's one of my favorite stories that they told me. And, you know, the story is essentially they finagle through sort of back-channel means and through not necessarily above-board decisions, which I won't give away, to procure this bike. And, yeah, it means the world to them. But it's also, right, a hint of sort of that desire for things and for a better life, right? And this idea that, right, in the United States, well, you could just get a bike, no problem. Or, you know, you'll make $12 an hour. You'll be able to send money home and get all this fancy stuff, you know? So there is like a sort of the undertone of like this capitalism acquiring of things that is really real, right, for people who are growing up in a state of lack and who also are sold this notion and told this notion that the North, El Norte, it's like this gilded place far away that some people get to go. And the vast majority of Salvadorans have a family member, whether it's a brother or a mother or a cousin, have somebody in their sort of extended families, if not many people, who live in the United States. So there's like it's like almost fundamentally biologically connected, the United States and El Salvador. And so everyone has this picture in their mind of what the United States is like.
Yeah, and it's important. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that clash of myth and reality there, because it is true, you have this mythic North, and then on the one hand, it doesn't really exist for the immigrants coming, and at the same time, another version of that mythic North depends on the immigrants coming for its very functioning.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a raw deal.
Yeah.
It's kind of a raw deal for the migrants. Yeah, the myth of the American dream is something we tell those of us who are born in the United States, and those of us maybe who've never left the United States or who have, or sell ourselves this idea that we're the best all the time, right? And I think, and actually I think a lot of atrophying can and does happen from that place of internally, like our own bolstering, self-bolstering that the American dream is alive and well. And if it weren't for this person or that person, I would have my slice of the American dream pie or whatever. But it's definitely something, I mean, you know, I've written about migrants coming from all over the world, and it's this idea of the United States and what's possible is just, it's pervasive. And then having interviewed and worked with so many migrants who've made their way to the United States and become immigrants, it's so rare that the dream matches up with the reality. It's also interesting, though, because, and this is something that the sister ended up being surprising to me. I wasn't expecting to write so much about her, the twin sister who stays at home. And she taught me a lot about so many things. But one of the things that was really interesting to me is that she would say things like, I know it's not like all milk and honey up there. You know, I know life is hard. I know that we don't understand how hard life is. Like, I know that. I know I can't imagine how hard it is. And at the same time, she's like, but I know that if I go, I could make it, right? Like, if I go, the dream would be possible for me. So she kind of held both the reality and the dream at the same time, which I thought was fascinating, right? Because it shows actually the power of myth and dreams, that it's just sort of, you're like, okay, well, even if all of the evidence tells me that the myth is not true, and I know that sort of intellectually, still somewhere in my belly and in my gut, you know, is this swirling dream? And I think that that's really interesting and telling.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I'm looking at the clock, and I think I have about time for two more questions, so I'm going to have to winnow them down.
I'll be faster in answering them.
No. Take your time. We'll go right up to the end, okay? One of them is this, and this is another one of these, like the bike story. This also stood out to me, and you talk about a corridor that allows safe passage for animals along the border.
Yeah, I know.
And yet, when it comes to humans, there is no safe passage, and oftentimes there's death.
Yep, exactly. So it's this park in... And that was actually a section that had come out of the first article I ever wrote about unaccompanied minors. But there's a park in southern Texas along the Rio Grande, in the Rio Grande Valley, called the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge. And this is a zone of Texas where, you know, much of this part of Texas, there is a border fence. And so sort of me, California girl, 6 years ago, I was sort of driving along the border being like, what's this giant fence? And it's like, oh, yeah, that's the border fence. But in Santa Ana, because it's a national wildlife refuge, or I'm sorry, it's not a national, I think it's a state wildlife refuge, because they were sort of reviving, it was sort of restored wetlands, all of these animal rights activists and sort of naturalist environmental activists got together and said, the fence must stop on either side of the national wildlife, you know, we have to stop, because otherwise you're going to have animals like the ocelot and the this and the that who can't get across and who are stuck, and it's very dangerous for them. So yeah, so that is now open explicitly for animals. And it just shows, I think, too, like the unnaturalness of a physical border barrier, because the thing to me, no matter how many borders I've visited, it's a fair number, it's just always so bizarre to me that it looks just exactly the same on one side as the other. It sounds so silly, but it's wild, right? Like it looks the same because it is the same. It's actually a fictitious designation, right? We've made it up. We've decided on this side that's that, and on this side that's that. But to animals, it's irrelevant, right? And humans are animals.
Yeah, yeah. All right, now we have about maybe 6 minutes to answer this one, okay? I want to talk about this, the root of the problem again. Why is, you know, look, you look at it, the root of the problem, it's dealing with why is Central America hemorrhaging people, as the way you put it in a book, which I thought was a very powerful way to put it, and the role of the U.S. in all this. You know, Bush, Obama, Trump, all of these people have played a role in basically the pillaging or forcing the pillaging of the populations of those three countries in particular, but also just throughout the world. But in relation to this, let's talk about the role of the U.S. in all of this and what's happening there.
Yeah, great question. I mean, so there's the legacy of war, which is just that, like, our Vietnam vets are still a big part of, you know, like, the trauma of Vietnam is still alive and well in the United States. And that was a war that was not fought on here, right? Like, in our home country. So the legacy of war is deep and long in El Salvador, and the United States contributed greatly to that, to those atrocities. Of course, like, the immigration policies that we have very much take advantage of migrants. And there are many industries, like where I live in California, the agricultural industry that feeds a good part of this country relies on undocumented workers and very hard workers at that. So there's all sorts of, like, foreign policy decisions, past and present, that we've made and are making that continue to exploit Central Americans. I mean, I think to me the biggest issue is that we think we can litigate immigration at the border. We actually think of immigration as a border issue. And to me, it's like what happens in a lot of sort of foreign policy, or our conception of problems and how to deal with them, is that we don't consider the source. So we think of immigration as what happens when someone steps across that bright red line. And then that's where, you know, we have to be at that bright red line and bring drones and bring, you know, retinal scans and bring helicopters and bring border patrol people and build fences, which is all those things we're doing. But why are people coming? That's not the question we're asking. We're saying, how do we stop them from coming? It doesn't work, right? Like, that's where people figure out how to get over walls or under walls or around. Like we know this to be true. For time immemorial at borders, people figure out how to cross them, especially desperate people. So I think the largest issue to me is how little we're looking at what's happening in these countries, and particularly in El Salvador, I can speak to because I've spent so much time there, that we're not looking at what the root causes is, the gang issues and the economic challenges there. And we could be doing a lot more to invest in supporting alternative opportunities there than, like, doing all that work at our border that isn't going to do anything besides further criminalize immigrants, push immigrants into harsh territory where they're more likely to die as they're trying to cross here. So I think it's really an issue of perspective. Like, are we focusing on the border? Or are we focusing on what brings people here?
And if you look at it too, though, I mean, it's also true that, yes, that's true, but it's also true that, look, for a long time, the U.S. and what it encouraging people to come up from Central America, from Mexico, these kinds of things where people were seen as the source of cheap labor and great profits
Absolutely.
For the U.S. industry. And,
Absolutely.
You know, and that's something very important for people to consider because, look, people migrate for survival. They don't migrate because they just get tired of the place they're living in. They migrate for survival. And then they come into this culture and their way of life and culture is smashed. And they come to this culture, which is all about serve the system, make, you know, for the U.S., it's like, how are they going to get the highest rate, both security-wise and profit-wise, in terms of what they're doing? And for a lot of these youth today, it involves the drudge jobs, you know, because of this is what's happening to the U.S. economy.
And those are the jobs you can get without papers, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Or with sort of insecure papers, so.
Anything else you'd like to add right before we go?
No, just want to thank you so much for this. I mean, I think, again, immigration is a hot topic of today, and it's also just an important issue that the United States has had to reckon with and needs to reckon with more of. And so, again, this kind of urging to think about what the root causes are. And again, this is something I didn't mention, getting out of the paradigm of pull factors, that people are being pulled to the United States. That's true, but that's not the whole story. The vast majority of these young people coming from Central America are being pushed out, and the United States is the place that they're going. But they're leaving because of what's happening on the ground, not because of the promise of what's going to happen here.
And the U.S. pillaging of their countries has a lot to do with what's happening on the ground these days.
Yes,
so.
Absolutely.
Very important.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much, Lauren. Really a pleasure talking
Thanks
with
so
you.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
An honor to be on your show. Thanks so much.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Lauren Markham, author of the book The Faraway Brothers, Two Young Migrants and the Making of an American Life, which has been called an urgent chronicle of contemporary immigration. It's the story of twin brothers growing up in El Salvador in the wake of the Civil War, being forced to flee as unaccompanied minors and struggling to find a new life in the U.S. And I got to tell you, folks, it's really a powerful book. It's one that you won't put down when you start reading it, and you'll learn a lot from it. And we should spread the word around about this very, very important book. All right.
That brings us to the end of another show, and I'd like to thank my two guests, Palestinian author and professor Sari Makdisi and writer Lauren Markham.
I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today. Where is he? Oh, there's Teddy Robinson, all right? And thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with a little bit more from Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
Oye, oye, oye.